Ladies, we start the program now. This evening, we're very honored to have with us some very good speakers tonight on women in politics in Minnesota. And Dr. Gretchen Kreuter from St. Olaf College will introduce them. And before you leave, will some of you fill out the evaluation sheet or next week so we can have some information about how you feel about the program? Dr. Kreuter?
In preceding weeks, we've discussed a whole variety, women in a whole variety of roles and occupations and professions. But one area that we really haven't touched upon is really the whole role of women and power, particularly political power. And this evening, we have an all-star cast that is going to fill in that gap beautifully. And begin by telling us something about the women's suffrage movement of the 19th and early 20th century, a movement which lasted for 80 years before success finally came. And then we will also hear about the role of women in third party movements in Minnesota, because as you know, Minnesota politics has a long and very distinguished tradition of third party politics and also of women's participation in them. And then we will hear about the role of women in politics today and an issue that is really central, I think, to the concerns of all of us, namely the whole matter of equal rights, the Equal Rights Amendment, equal rights legislation. And so first of all, I would like to introduce to you one of our historian panel members, Dolores Johnson, who is going to talk to us about the slow growth of women's suffrage. Dolores.
It may surprise you to hear, as it surprised me, that the campaign for suffrage in Minnesota began before the state was officially a state. Harriet Bishop arrived in St. Paul about 1847 to begin a long and distinguished career as a school teacher, and she also campaigned for women's suffrage. She was not alone. We know, for example, that in 1858, Mary J. Colburn gave a lecture in the village of Champlin on the rights of women. In the conventions to form the state's constitution, a wing of the Democratic Party proposed that women be allowed to vote. That was, married women be allowed to vote. The proposition was regarded as frivolous and hardly noticed, we are told. The Civil War intensified efforts for women's suffrage. Women demonstrated their capabilities, particularly in the area of nursing, on the battlefields and in the field hospitals. Jane Grey Swisham, the St. Cloud abolitionist who has been called the mother of the Republican Party in Minnesota, spoke to the state Senate on women's rights in 1862. And while the campaign for suffrage went on throughout the war, the end of the war brought suffrage only to black men. Women were still excluded. And women did not take this casually. We find in diaries, journals, and memoirs of this time the bitterness and resentment that women felt being denied a right which had been extended to former slaves whom they had helped to free. But they continued to work, not for equal rights, but simply for their right to vote. In 1875, the state legislature submitted for ratification an amendment to the state constitution which would enable women to vote for members of school boards and to also hold school offices. On their ballots, men faced a "yes, we have no bananas" wording of the proposition, and it passed. Women had now their own ballot boxes at election time, and while they were limited in their voting, they were voting. They had a foot in the door of the all-male elective establishment. And they continued to work for full suffrage. In 1881, the suffrage movement in Minnesota was officially organized by Sarah Berger Stearns, who had come to Rochester in 1866. She was the first president of the Minnesota Women's Suffrage Association, affiliated with the National Woman Suffrage Association. The members of the association began a long, frustrating time of organizing the state into suffrage clubs, carrying a wide variety of names: the Equal Suffrage Associations, Political Equality Clubs, Women's Clubs, and so forth. They organized, were abandoned, and reorganized. Full suffrage was not what every woman wanted, so the leaders of the movement propagandized a great deal, and I do not mean this in a pejorative sense, and took what concessions they could get. While women might not approve of full suffrage, they could be persuaded that their voice was necessary not only in regard to their children's schools, but their libraries as well. And so in 1898, they managed to get voter ratification of an amendment which allowed women to vote for members of the library board and to hold office in that system as well. The leaders of the movement were well aware that they were compromising on the issue of full suffrage, but in making it possible for women to vote now on two questions, they were opening the door a little wider, and women were being accustomed to voting. The suffrage movement in the 19th century did not carry the cachet of respectability. Brenda Yulin writes that her mother, Clara Hampson Yulin, who was to become one of the great leaders for suffrage in this state, regarded the early leaders of the suffrage movement, such as Dr. Martha Ripley and Drs. Anna and Ethel Hurd, as, quote, eccentric and forceful women, unquote. She joined the movement in 1901, only after three close friends had joined, and she did not become active until about 1909, when her daughter Elsa became the first president of the College Equal Suffrage Club at the University of Minnesota. After 1910, the movement gained in respectability. As a matter of fact, it was eminently respectable, and its membership and influence grew. The suffragists now managed to have a bill introduced regularly into each legislative session, usually by Senator Ole Oseigen. During each legislative session, petitions were submitted, conferences were held, demonstrations and parades were organized. The suffragists, in their colors of yellow and black, lobbied here in Minnesota and in other states, not only with the members of the legislature, but at the national level in Washington, not only at the state party conventions, but at the national party conventions, but with few real results. For according to William Watts Falwell, quote, a proposition to subvert the immemorial status of women, believed by multitudes to be sanctioned by Holy Scripture, awaited a tardy reversal of sentiment. But there was an organization whose membership was not patient and wanted action now. Alice Paul organized the Congressional Union in 1913. Its headquarters were in Washington, and its tactics were more militant than those of the National Women's Suffrage Association. Members of the union put up a picket line at the first inauguration of Woodrow Wilson, and after that began a series of demonstrations in Washington which resulted in mass arrests. Those who were arrested followed the example of their British sisters and went on hunger strikes. Prison officials found that they could hold women prisoners for 5 days without their suffering any serious physical effects. And so after the first incidents, suffragist prisoners were released after serving their 5 days. The president of the Congressional Union in Minnesota, Sarah Tarleton Colvin, was arrested twice. Her autobiography, A Rebel in Thought, is a valuable history of not only the suffrage movement, but the history of the establishment of educational standards for the training of nurses in Minnesota. And it is as well a wonderful account of the development of the consciousness of a suffragist. In 1916, the Congressional Union openly split from the Suffrage Association over not only tactics, but on the issue of support of Democratic candidates. Because the party and its leader, President Woodrow Wilson, would not endorse suffrage, the Congressional Union campaigned actively against all Democratic candidates. The Suffrage Association, meanwhile, preferred to keep itself above and removed from partisan politics. Politics, after all, at that time, was still regarded as a dirty business. The union also differed with the National Association over which suffrage amendment to support. The union supported the Anthony Amendment, which called for an amendment to the National Constitution. although it was to change its position later on. The Suffrage Association supported the idea of obtaining suffrage through amendments to the respective state constitutions. Here in Minnesota, the Minnesota Women's Suffrage Association worked with the Congressional Union in support of the Anthony Amendment because of the difficulty in amending this state's constitution. There were, however, Minnesota suffrage clubs which supported the official national position, and suffragists found themselves not only in opposition to the anti-suffragists, but in the unlikely position of testifying against one another at hearings in the state capitol. As it became clear that a national amendment was to pass, Clara Ulin, in fact, asked that a state suffrage bill, which was assured of passage, be withdrawn. If you sense from this that the suffrage movement was made up of widely varying factions, almost always at odds, and often agreeing on nothing else but the need for the right to vote, you are absolutely correct. But war again helped the suffrage movement. In the patriotic fervor which surrounded World War I, President Wilson finally went on record supporting suffrage for women, citing the need for, quote, the sympathy and insight and clear moral instinct of the women of the world in solving the world's problems, which he anticipated having to solve after the war was won. Congress and the Senate were not swayed by his arguments. But after the close of the war, on June 4, 1919, a measure was passed to submit the 19th Amendment to the states for ratification. The Minnesota legislature ratified the amendment in the fall of 1919 in a special session. And on August 26, 1920, the 19th Amendment became part of the Constitution. And so, in a sense, the long struggle was over. In another sense, it was and is not. Alice Paul and the women of the Congressional Union recognized, as had Susan B. Anthony many years before, that suffrage alone would not guarantee women equality, and they were determined to have equality. The Congressional Union became the National Women's Party in 1920, and in 1923, Myrtle Cain, a member of that party and a member of the Farmer Labor Party, and one of the four women elected to the Minnesota legislature, introduced an equal rights amendment. She and Alice Paul are still working for that amendment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, I'd like to introduce to you Rhoda Gilman of the Minnesota Historical Society, who will talk to us about women in third-party movements in Minnesota. Rhoda.
One of the interesting things about the social, the suffrage movement, which you may have gathered from Dolores' talk, is that its leadership was made up largely of highly educated, middle-class, professional women, women who very often were the wives or daughters of prominent men. In this respect, it traces its roots perhaps to the New England background of so many of Minnesota's early political leaders, both in the territory and the state. There is, however, a competing political tradition among Minnesota women. It was a tradition that demanded social and economic justice first and saw legal and political equality for women as growing naturally from a more just and humanitarian society. This tradition found its most effective expression in radical and third-party groups, and it drew to the support of these groups the state's most impassioned and talented political spokeswomen. In Minnesota, as elsewhere, the greatest weakness of the suffrage movement was that it failed to arouse any substantial support among rural and working-class women and among immigrants. Even though some of the latter were themselves deeply committed to social change. For example, Finnish women on Minnesota's Iron Range brought with them a strong tradition of feminism and activism. But this found expression not in the suffrage movement, but in the Socialist Party, in labor unions, in cooperatives, and in their own Finnish language feminist publication. The same was true of working women, then as now, found that abstract equality has a hollow ring compared with tangible economic and social benefits for themselves and their children. The representatives of this reform, and if you will, radical tradition, were without exception brilliant and articulate, and often they were difficult. For individualism and courage, they are hard to match, even in a state that has specialized in producing political mavericks. The first, both in influence and in time, is Jane Grey Swisshelm. As Dolores mentioned, she was at one point burned in effigy as the mother of the Republican Party. I have not planned to go in any detail at all into Swisshelm's career. There was supposed to have been a talk on her earlier in this series. I don't believe it was given. But to summarize briefly, she arrived in Minnesota in 1857 and left, never to return, in 1863. During that period, she became the state's leading spokeswoman for abolitionism. As has been mentioned, she was closely associated with the founding of the state's Republican Party. This may raise the question as to why she is considered a part of the third party tradition, but we have to remember that the Republican Party was not technically a third party in 1859 when this burning occurred. Republicanism was still a radical experiment. It was a melange of abolitionists, prohibitionists, anti-Catholic know-nothings, and a large body of ex-Whigs and free soil Democrats who were united on only one principle, that slavery should not be extended to the vast territories of the American West. In Minnesota, the Republicans were also united by opposition to a Democratic machine that had grown fat and corrupt through nearly a decade of undisturbed control over land offices and Indian agencies. Swisshelm, however, was an abolitionist before she was a Republican and an advocate of property and legal rights for women before she was a suffragist. It was her horror of human slavery that drove her to the lecture platform and her conviction that women must be protected from exploitation and abuse that led her to demand the vote. Time passed and issues changed, but when waves of agrarian protest washed over Minnesota in the 1880s and 1890s, another feminine comet flashed across the political sky. Like Swisshelm, Eva McDonald Valesh ignored the limitations of disenfranchisement and preached the cause of social justice in the political arena. In the literature of populism, this young journalist and union organizer from Minneapolis is often mentioned with the more famous Mary E. Leese of Kansas and other women who spoke for the People's Party across the nation. In Minnesota, she was the most widely heard voice of labor in the third party movement, and she challenged even Ignatius Donnelly for its leadership. Who was Eva McDonald, and what was the source of this influence? The first fact to remember is that women comprised a large proportion of the new industrial labor force in the Twin Cities of the 1880s. And it was the first major strike in Minnesota occurred in April 1888 and was held by 250 women who made shirts and overalls in a sweatshop operated by the Minneapolis firm of Shotwell, Clarihue, and Loffman. Many of these strikers were members of the Knights of Labor, which had chartered two ladies' protective assemblies in the Twin Cities and had taken a forthright stand for equal pay for women in the same jobs as men. Although the Knights did not officially endorse or lead this strike, master worker Timothy W. Brosnan of the state organization and John P. McGoy, an organizer and national officer of the Noble Order, were present at most of the strike meetings. And it was there that McGoy first became aware of Eva McDonald. She was not one of the workers, but she had written a newspaper account of conditions in the factory that had aroused widespread community sympathy for the strike. His article was one of a series that she had done. McDonald was the daughter of a Minneapolis carpenter and was herself a typesetter and a member of the Typographers Union. She had been asked to do the series on working women in the Twin Cities because of the need for a reporter who could gain the confidence of young factory women and at the same time pass for an ordinary job applicant in the eyes of suspicious employers. The series quickly established her as a professional journalist. When her friends among the striking garment workers asked her to say a few words at one of their meetings, McGoy was immediately impressed by the tiny, boyish-looking pixie with close-cropped curly hair and intense, earnest manner. He took her aside afterward, and what followed assumed in Eva's later memory the proportions of a Pygmalion legend. McGoy undertook to train her in public speaking and make of her an orator and a labor agitator. He introduced her to the ferment of radical and reformist ideas that was shaking the complacency of the late 19th century world, prescribed a course of reading in the literature of economics and social criticism, and took her to gatherings of a select group within the leadership of the Knights of Labor. That was a sort of ideological steering committee which met to discuss the ideology of the movement and comprised the intellectual leadership of the movement in Minnesota. It was a heady atmosphere for a young woman of 22 in the 1880s. McGoy's tutoring of her ended at a meeting which both of them were to address. She gave his customary speech as well as her own, leaving him with nothing to say. Following this, he informed her that she, quote, had graduated. By then, however, her glib command of radical social thought, together with her effective writing and speaking, had won her a firm place within the inner circle of Twin Cities labor leadership. Now, at this time, as you perhaps remember, the growing militancy of organized labor in Minnesota was matched by unrest among the state's farmers. And in 1886, the two groups came together in a convention and agreed to work together politically. This was a rather uneasy relationship, off again, on again, but it proved effective enough to throw a major scare into the two major parties. It was Dr. Everett W. Fish, who was the editor of the Alliance, Farmers Alliance newspaper, The Great West, who first drew Eva McDonald into the orbit of the farmers' movement. He heard her lecture at a labor meeting, was deeply impressed by her talent, and asked her if she would not lecture around the state to the farmers on the need for farmer labor cooperation. He also engaged her to write for a brief time, a column for the Great West. In one issue, she probably dismayed him somewhat by giving her impressions of the Alliance State Convention held in March 1890. Quote, I felt rather subdued on seeing over 500 delegates assembled to represent the farmers' interests and not a woman among them, she wrote. If I were convinced that the women of the rural districts of this state are carefully educated, well-clothed, well-fed, and not overworked, I wouldn't say a word about their absence from the convention. But if the average farmer is a slave, then his wife is the slave of a slave. Her position is fixed by his and is always a little the worse of the two. She advocated admitting women to full membership in the Alliance, pointing out that in industrial organizations, women have proven themselves the equal of men in every respect. As a lecturer, she was well received by the farmers and local Alliance people around the state. Her message, repeated continually, was, of course, the common interests of farm and labor. In 1891, she was elected to the office of state lecturer of the Alliance, which was analogous to the organizer for a labor union. She was elected by a two-thirds vote of the membership over the opposition of Dr. Fish, who by that time had suspected that she had political ambitions of her own and could not easily be controlled. He pointed out that she was not, as a woman, a member of the organization and never could be. However, the rank and file elected her anyway. In the meantime, tensions had increased between the labor and farmer factions in the state's Alliance Labor Union Party, which was the political arm of the Alliance movement, and Eva quickly became the chief voice of labor on the Alliance Executive Council. When Donnelly, who was the unquestioned leader of the farm faction, was invited to represent Minnesota at a national convention in Cincinnati to create a nationwide people's movement, she and several others traveled to Ohio and challenged his right to speak for their party. But the sage of Nininger, scarred by some 30 years of political battle, was more than equal to the strident voice of a 25-year-old woman. Although she was outmaneuvered at the convention, McDonald seized an offer to lecture for the People's Party nationally and spent the summer hobnobbing with the great names of populism, sockless Jerry Simpson, James B. Weaver, Mary Leese, Annie Diggs, and many others. However, her marriage that summer to Frank Valesh, a young Czech cigar maker who was the first president of the Minnesota State Federation of Labor, quickly put a brake on her political career. She nearly died with the birth of her first child in 1892, and it was some time before she could resume her writing and lecturing. Meanwhile, the populist movement had crested in Minnesota, and although the party continued to run candidates until 1896, it never again posed a major threat to the two-party system. McDonald made her last public appearance in Minnesota when she introduced William Jennings Bryan to an ecstatic Minneapolis audience during his first presidential campaign in 1896. Soon after that, she took her four-year-old son and turned her back on her husband, on Minnesota, and on the third-party movement. She went to New York, and for several years, she worked as a reporter for Hearst's New York Journal. Then she returned to the labor movement, and for 8 years, edited the American Federationist for Samuel Gompers. She quit that because Gompers refused to put her name on the masthead. Already, she had become involved with the Women's Trade Union League and the New York Socialites who supported it, and that led in time to her starting a magazine called The American Clubwoman, which for some years was the unofficial organ of the General Federation of Women's Clubs. When Eva McDonald died in 1956, at the age of 90, Minnesota's populist past and her own were distant memories, and her name was scarcely recalled in the state where she had made her deepest mark. New generations of feminists and radicals had succeeded where she had failed, and while she retreated steadily into conservatism on labor and social issues, Midwestern third-party leaders associated with an even more powerful wave of farmer-labor cooperation had taken her place. The Populist Party in the 1890s had gone on record in its national platform in favor of woman suffrage, and later third-party movements were even more aggressive. The socialist newspaper, The New Times, which was published in Minneapolis during the first two decades of the 20th century, was loud and constant in its demand for women's rights. The cooperative commonwealth of the future, it made very clear, would include women on an equal basis with men. In the meantime, like populism, socialism welcomed women as theorists and agitators, even though they could not yet vote. One such woman was Anna A. Maley, a member of the party's National Executive Committee, a writer, editor, lecturer, organizer, and sometime candidate. She was born in Sibley County. She lived at various times in Kansas, New York, North Dakota, and in Washington State, where she once ran for governor on the socialist ticket. Returning to Minnesota in 1915, she was in time to help socialism reach its high tide here with the election of Thomas Van Leer, a socialist, as mayor of Minneapolis in 1916. She worked for Van Leer's administration, and in 1918, as the party's candidate for school board, she was roundly accused of disloyalty and sedition, along with most other socialist candidates during that period of hysterical red baiting during World War I. After her defeat, the Minneapolis Journal heaved a sigh of relief, stating that the emphatic refusal of the people to put another socialist on the school board in the person of the brilliant but dangerous Anna Maley is highly reassuring. Her death a few days later brought forth a spontaneous demonstration of grief when thousands of workers, according to the Minneapolis Labor Review, quote, laid down their tools and marched from Bridge Square to 13th Street as a guard to see that the robbing exploiters who had hounded and vilified her did not disturb her remains. No woman in the history of Minneapolis, according to the paper, was ever paid the honor which was given to Anna Maley. Out of the same milieu came Marion Wharton LeSueur, also a writer, lecturer, teacher, and editor. With her husband, the brilliant socialist lawyer Arthur LeSueur, and with her children by a previous marriage, she moved to the Twin Cities during the years of repression and political turmoil that accompanied and followed World War I. Together, they plunged into the politics of the new farmer labor movement that was slowly taking shape from the agrarian nonpartisan league and the fragmented socialist party, along with the growing industrial unions. Marion LeSueur would continue to be active in the party until 1948, but in all her political struggles, writes her daughter, Maridel LeSueur, she was never given a political office. Like most women, she was relegated to the hot dish, the dishwashing, at most the column in the paper, and her magnificent oratory. Nevertheless, she became a power and a tradition in the Farmer Labor Party. Governor Floyd B. Olson appointed her to the State Planning Board and to the Board of Education. And briefly, during the 1940s, she served as editor of the Farmer Labor Leader. She was also chairwoman of the newly merged Democratic Farmer Labor Party from 1944 to 1948. Her last political gesture was in 1952, when, with McCarthyism at its height, she ran for United States Senator on the Progressive Party ticket in defiant protest to the Korean War. The Farmer Labor Party was also the political vehicle for several lesser-known Minnesota women. Susie W. Stageberg, a teacher from Red Wing, was its candidate for Secretary of State in 1922, 1924, and 1928, and ran for Congress with its endorsement in 1932. Jean Wittick of Minneapolis, who was state president of the League of Women Voters and an independent Republican, found no outlet for her talents through her own party. But in 1930, when she organized the All-Party Volunteer Committee, which helped secure the election of Floyd B. Olson as governor, she was on the high road to statewide influence. Olson possibly had an eye to her master's degree in economics and her Phi Beta Kappa key when he appointed her commissioner of administration and finance. Today, Minnesota has no third party and no apparent prospects of any, but no one who knows anything of our state's volatile political history would venture to predict that there will not be one again. In the meantime, it will be interesting to see where those activist Minnesota women who are dedicated to social reform and feminism find their political pathway opening. Will it be through nonpartisan and independent women's caucuses, or through the feminist caucuses of the established parties, or through some new political combination that has yet to take shape? In any case, we can be sure that the Jane Swisshelms, the Eva McDonalds, the Anna Maleys, and the Marion Lesueurs of the future will find a way to be heard.
Thank you very much, Rhoda. I'm going to go slightly out of order here, I think, and introduce next to you Nancy Bratis, who is a state senator from Minnesota, from Rochester, and also runs a computer consulting firm. Senator Bratis.
Thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be with you tonight. I've learned a tremendous number of facts. Astounding. You can't imagine how pleased that I am to know all of that now. And I feel rather guilty I wasn't well-backgrounded before. The theme I've been asked to talk about tonight is women in politics today. And obviously, this is a topic that I'm more than mildly interested in. I hope, though, that by weaving in a few facts regarding the history of women in politics, that we can help us in our present day as women in politics, women interested in politics, as well as in the future. When I first heard the previous two speakers' topics, I thought that I was going to have to X out a lot, but I have different historical facts, and perhaps some of them will come as news to you. It's not news to you that the fight for women's rights has been going on for a long time. We've had excellent presentations giving concrete examples of that in Minnesota in particular. But women in politics have been leaders in that fight all across our country. I'd like to take you back to the birth of our nation, for example, when Abigail Adams asked husband John, as he's off to write the Constitution, to remember the ladies. Now, it didn't happen, but at least she was there reminding him, so it has been going on for a long time. Frances Wright and Ernestine Rose and others championed the cause of women's rights in the early 1800s. However, the immediate origin of the women's rights movement of the mid-1800s was the anti-slavery crusade. Now, at the World Anti-Slavery Crusade in 1840, a group of American women delegates found themselves excluded from the convention. Imagine, these women in politics were duly elected delegates, had traveled to England with their husbands, which was no small feat in those days, as we all know, and got to the door of the convention and were not admitted. Through this experience, the women realized that the cause of emancipation affected them as well as the slaves. Two of them were Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucretia Mott. 8 years later, on July 19, 1848, at a convention in Wesleyan Chapel in Seneca Falls, New York, a handful of nervous but very determined housewives rose before the crowd, and one of their members, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, read aloud from a manifesto, and I'm going to quote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal," ran the preamble, paraphrasing another notable document. And I'll continue to quote, "The history," read Elizabeth Cady Stanton, "of mankind is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations on the part of man toward woman." The manifesto went on to catalog the social and legal disabilities women suffered under, but it did not stop there. It challenged women for the first time in history to rise up and fight for their rights. And in 12 hard-hitting resolutions, it spelled out some concrete demands. One of them, inserted by that same young housewife, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, was the demand for the right to vote. It seemed so presumptuous, it just threw the whole convention in an uproar. Even her best friend, Lucretia Mott, said, "Lizzie, thee will make us ridiculous. We must go slowly." Now, women have been hearing that before Lucretia Mott's time, since Lucretia Mott's time, and today. The right to vote, however, became the flaming issue in the crusade for women's rights, emblazoning the better part of a century with its banners and enlisting the life's energies of outstanding women. And we've heard about many of those women here tonight. It took the nation a dismaying 72 years to acknowledge that right. And after they gained the vote in 1920, the women of America discovered that they had won only a battle, not a war. But as the war goes on, Seneca Falls is still a symbolic rallying point. The planning for this Seneca Falls convention began on July 13, 1848. That night, five women planned a meeting to be held 6 days later. Now, all of you have planned meetings. How many people would you expect if you sat down with four of your friends and planned a meeting for 6 days later? The next morning, Seneca Falls read in its newspaper an unexpected invitation, and again I quote, "to discuss the social, civil, and religious condition and rights of women at the Wesleyan Chapel on Wednesday and Thursday." There's the invitation. 300 men and women attended. 300 in 6 days. One-third of them eventually signed what is known as the Declaration of Sentiments, a statement which Elizabeth Cady Stanton had patterned after the Declaration of Independence, substituting women's grievances against men for the colony's complaints against King George. Now, those who subscribed to the Declaration passed unanimously all but one of the prepared 12 resolutions, and I bet you can guess which one it was. That one, declaring it the duty of women to gain the sacred right of elected franchise, unquote, nearly split the convention, but finally passed by a majority vote. Now, as we've heard tonight, President Wilson finally agreed to support suffrage in 1916. In January of 1918, at Wilson's urging, the House of Representatives finally passed the 19th Amendment, the Susan B. Anthony Amendment, by precisely the two-thirds vote required. But it took more than 18 months to bring the Senate around. Some say the Senate's always slow. And an additional year, the most nerve-wracking of all, to get the required 36 states to ratify the amendment. Sound familiar? On August 26, 1920, 72 years after Elizabeth Cady Stanton urged it at Seneca Falls, the women of America won the vote. Carrie Chapman Catt toted up the price of that victory. 52 years of campaigning, 56 state referendum campaigns, 480 drives to get state legislatures to submit suffrage amendments to voters, 317 campaigns to get state and national party conventions to include suffrage planks, and 19 campaigns for the 19th Amendment with 19 congresses. As Mrs. Catt told her followers, that vote has been costly. Prize it. Today, the Seneca Falls laundromat stands in place of the Wesleyan Chapel. This seems appropriate, because once the vote was won, women returned to the business of living, to the cleaning and the washing and the tidying of their individual lives. A laundromat is a place, as we all know, where women come together out of their isolation. It is a togetherness of a domestic ritual. There is no illusion of realizing potential. And so the suffrage movement, though successful, actually was merely a detour along the road to the ultimate goal of equal rights for women. The right to vote was the first milepost. The second milepost was never defined, and hence the journey was largely on back roads by a few brave travelers for another 50 years. And we've had excellent presentations about some of these brave travelers tonight by the two previous speakers. Though women in 1920, of course, had the potential ability, the vast majority were neither qualified due to lack of education and training, nor motivated to compete with men for political office or practically any other endeavor. Perhaps in the mind of many, the real turning point for women in politics came about when FDR appointed a woman as a member of his cabinet. Frances Perkins became Secretary of Labor in 1932 during the height of the Depression, at a time when the labor movement was racked with turbulent strikes and riots. That a woman could land such an important appointment shocked and surprised the nation. But it did not trigger a sudden rush by millions of women to emulate her example. Remember that Carla Hills, when recently appointed Secretary of HUD by President Ford, the nation was again surprised by the novelty. Now, why is it so slow for women in politics? In truth, many women have been actively seeking careers in politics, careers of all kinds over the years. But the process was not emphasized or organized. Their ability was not generally recognized. So progress has come slowly, painfully, individually, and one at a time. I know myself, when I first became active in politics over 20 years ago, it really wasn't the socially acceptable thing to do. And so we've come a long way now. We all know it's the socially acceptable, not only socially, but morally acceptable thing to do. In 1963, Betty Friedan wrote her astonishing book, The Feminine Mystique, and many people date the birth of the modern women's movement, including women in politics, from that time. It is a striking parallel when one recognizes that just as the initial women's rights movement was motivated by the slavery question in the 1840s, so it is today that we see the revival of the women's rights following in close sequence the black civil rights movement of the 1960s. Which brings us up to this moment in history, this day, this night. How can we as women live up to our full potential as women in politics, as women in pursuit of any career interest? I believe we must really begin to view the women's rights movement in a new light, a broader light, if you will. I often have said how much I appreciate the women, some of them were mentioned tonight, way back when, and I am the recipient of all those battles that they fought. But just as with a human being, there is a transition period, a growth from infancy through juvenile stage and on into maturity, we should realize as women where we are today. We are mature, and with it should come the self-confidence that maturity brings. Initially, the yeast of the women's movement was strident advocacy. In order for women now to actually rise, when given the opportunity, I believe the true leavening agent must now become constructive, responsible, and competent action. It is highly unattractive that whenever progress is made, that the complaining goes on. Certainly we want to point out injustices, but we don't want to get in the position that we are going to backslide, as we have seen through the speeches that have been given tonight and in some of my remarks. I believe it's important for some women to stay within the women's movement. They are performing a great service by assuring public awareness. But I believe it's just as important for other women to graduate from the movement and to go into other endeavors, running for political office, women in politics, for example. It's my belief, however, that women should not go into politics or any job expecting to be put down or discriminated against. Militancy and paranoia are not going to save, win, or keep the day when diligence and creative productivity are called for. It is not always easy. I will not say that I have never been discriminated against. However, if I had spent my last 20 years keeping track of all of that, I would have had time for nothing else. So I'm not talking about turning the cheek and ignoring it. I'm talking about the times when it is appropriate to bring it up and the times when it's appropriate to work to overcome it. I think it's important that we as a woman, every last one of us, take inventory and stock. Where do we belong in the scheme of things to come, and how do we get there? Bemoaning past failure offers no panacea, in my opinion, for future success, in politics or in any other endeavor. In my view, women's rights means freedom of choice. That is, the right to a career inside or outside of the home, or both. Freedom from prejudice and equal opportunity. That is, the right to be recognized as an individual, a person, an entity, regardless of the task at the moment. Now, none of us would disagree on that. Ancy Morse, a mother of four children and a practicing attorney in my hometown, Rochester, Minnesota, recently expressed some thoughts that I believe are the essence of women's rights. Speaking before the Rochester Business and Professional Women, she said, and I'm quoting, "Our society ought to be liberated enough that it considers caring for a home and family a meaningful option. At the same time, those options ought to include careers once thought of as male activities. I hope," continued Nancy Morse, "that when my daughters are grown, they can be homemakers without apology or career women without explanation." End quote. However, I personally don't believe that just motivation and ambition are necessarily assurances of a bed of roses at the end of the path, and none of us believe that. Ancy Morse put this concept very well, and again, I'm going to quote her. "Employment out of the home for a woman is a mixed bag. Women who are bored at home and think they can escape the carpools and scout troops or go to lunch all the time, as working women supposedly do, are getting a Hollywood glamour version of careers. The professional world may not be equal to that expectation. It probably means sending your family off in the morning and discovering the dog is 7 blocks away unfed, eating a sandwich at your desk at the office. And if I were to ever total up the number of sandwiches at the desk as opposed to lunches out, you know which one would win. Yes, everybody's shaking their head. It may mean arriving home still preoccupied with the problems of the day and having your children descend upon you at the door saying, 'What's for dinner?'" In closing, I guess what I've concluded, and probably you have too, there is no utopia to be found in either striking out or staying put. As far as women in political careers are concerned, I would like to see more women in politics at all levels of government, as candidates, as elected public officials, as paid professionals, and as volunteers. And so, as we celebrate this bicentennial project of yours, I believe it's important to encourage women to enter politics, because when we study the history of any movement, whether it be civil rights, human rights, or women's rights, we discover that with all of the parades and all of the demonstrations and all of the publicity, the one and only avenue that provides ultimate change is the political process. So long before I was a candidate for public office, I urged women to become involved in politics. And I urge you tonight, you here tonight, to do so as an opportunity to make a real contribution for yourself, for your others, for the two-party system, as a token of gratitude for the generations of women who have made it possible to enjoy the emancipation that we are beginning to enjoy today, and perhaps most importantly, to leave a still stronger legacy to those generations of women still to come. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Now I'd like to introduce someone else who has long been encouraging women to become more involved in political activity, and who has done a little of that herself. Arvon Fraser, very active in the Women's Political Caucus and founder of the Women's Equity Action League, who's going to talk to us about women legislators. Arvon.
Thanks very much. There have been 22 women in the Minnesota legislature up to 1974. Four of those women were elected the first time women could be elected in 1923. Of those four, three came from Minneapolis and one from northwestern Minnesota, and that's a pattern that has been followed fairly consistently. One of the women, Myrtle Kane, whom you heard about before, came from northeast Minneapolis. Maybeth Hurd Page came from the other side of the river, what in her day was known as Lowry Hill. Today it's Kenwood. Sue Dickey Huff, who came from south Minneapolis, and Hannah Kempfer, who came from Erhard, Minnesota. There has been, up to 1974, one senator, and now, of course, there with Nancy Bratis, there have been two. There has been one member of the Minnesota legislature, one female member, who went on to Congress, and another one who tried to and was defeated in the primary. Interestingly enough, both of these women came from the same legislative district and ran, of course, in the same congressional district. The year 1974 has been characterized as a breakthrough for women in politics. Nationally, 130 women were newly elected to state legislatures, making a total of 600 women. That is distorted a little by the number in New Hampshire, and New Hampshire has the biggest legislature in the whole country. So in Minnesota, the numbers of women running for office increased greatly in the 1970s. And although only 8 women were elected to the state legislature in 1974, this is the largest number to serve at any one time. And Joan Anderson Groh, in 1974, became the 4th Minnesota woman to be elected to statewide office. She left the House and became, as you all know, Secretary of State. Of the 8 women serving in the House and Senate in 1975, 3 House members, one of whom is here, Phyllis Kahn, 3 House members, Linda Berglund, Mary Forsyth, and Phyllis Kahn, were first elected in 1973. All of those, again, from Minneapolis or suburbs of Minneapolis. Those elected in 74 were Peggy Byrne, the first woman to represent Ramsey County in the whole 50 years, Janet Clark of Minneapolis, Shirley Hokanson of Richfield, and Claudia Meyer of Rice or Benton County, and then Nancy Bratis, who was elected to an unexpired term or to a new term in February of 75. So that's a beginning, 1923, and an end, 1974. And let me talk a minute about a few sample legislators, shall we say, women legislators. Some I wrote about in a book I hope is going to be published, in which there's a chapter that Sue Holbert and I did on Minnesota women legislators. And some of them I knew, Myrtle Kane specifically, and hopefully give you a little bit of flavor of women's political history. First one I want to talk about is Maybeth Hurd Page. I've tried and tried to think of a two-word description of her, and a couple I came up with was a respectable renegade, but that doesn't quite fit, or elegant frustration, and that doesn't quite fit either. She was a combination of kind of an aristocrat and a maverick, aristocratic maverick. Maybe that's it. Anyhow, she served in the legislature, the Minnesota legislature, from 1923 to 1943. 11 terms, 11 consecutive terms. Born in Massachusetts, her father was a doctor and her mother was ill most of the time. It's fascinating. She rode around, and that was, that that was really a great influence on her life, I think. She rode around the neighborhood, the countryside, with her father. Her father was a great intellectual. He was not only a doctor, a scientist, very interested in religion, terribly interested in people. And he passed a lot of this on to Mabeth Hurd Page. I think also she was from one of the old families of her town and came out somewhat aristocratic, let's say this. But she wanted to be an artist and went on to art school and eventually came to Minneapolis as an art teacher, where she met James Page, affectionately known by my father-in-law as Jimmy Page, and who was an autocrat of the first order. She became the dutiful wife of the law professor and went to law school here at the University of Minnesota. But she also, at the same time, James Page was lived in a family run by an equally autocratic older sister, with a father who of the family was never present, I think, to escape the situation. And Mabeth Page was, as a bride, was dumped into this family, literally, and made to live on the third floor in kind of I won't quite say the attic since it was finished off, but it was a terrible situation. And part of her refuge was to go to the library and read, or to go to law school. Finally, a child came along, and through that child, she met a number of people in the neighborhood of Kenwood and got active in the Women's Christian Association, and there her organizational talents and her intellectual frustration found really an avenue of expression. And there is a hall, the Women's Christian Association built residence halls for the young working women who came to the evil city to work. And these residence halls actually were a great benefit to many of them. There is one now named Mabeth Page Hall on 4th Avenue and 7th Street in Minneapolis and is still operating. Mabeth Page also got active in the women's suffrage movement. She ultimately served on the national board of the League of Women Voters. And when suffrage came along, she kept speaking about women running for office, and somebody said, well, why not you? And she decided, why not, and filed under the name of Mrs. James Page at the request of her husband. Later, the Attorney General requested her to change that, and she took the name Mabeth Hurd Page and ran on that. Thereafter. Jimmy Page, however, loved the campaigns. A strange man he really was. And he picked her campaign picture. He made her lawn signs and I think was the inventor of the whole lawn sign business in Minneapolis, at least. Some days I thank him and some days I don't. He worked the Gateway area. The Gateway area is what we now call the urban renewal area, Washington Avenue, what used to be the slum. I guess it was called the Gateway because there was a kind of a gate, and it was near the two railroad stations, and when I was young, called bums, lived in the Gateway. It was full of old hotels. Jimmy Page worked the Gateway, but so did Mabeth Hurd Page herself, and got a big vote from among men mostly living there, with the assistance of a female hotel owner who became one of her great friends. Here's this aristocratic lady working the Gateway. She loved people. She was absolutely fascinated by people, and at the same time appalled at some of the conditions women had to endure. In her biography, written by a friend of hers, one of her first early shocking memories was watching the young girls that she had gone to elementary school with become mill hands and see them on the streets after work. The description of this gives one the impression that it made a lifelong impression on her, and she worked a great deal when she was in the legislature for women and children. She was an independent because she was rebuffed by the Republican Party when she went to run for the state legislature. And, of course, she joined the conservative caucus up until very recently. Our legislature was not designated by Republicans or Democrats. She was either conservative or liberal. And she joined the conservative caucus. She feared and hated Floyd B. Olson and Elmer Benson, but was a friend of and befriended Hannah Kempfer, another woman who was elected at the same time. Mabethard Page served on the Public Welfare and Education Committee, Appropriations, Judiciary, University of Minnesota, Public Domain, very active in the Boundary Waters Canoe area in establishing it. To illustrate James Page, and he took her very pregnant on a dangerous canoe trip. Their summer vacations were planned ahead of time, and by golly, pregnant or not, she was going to go on this canoe trip, and she did and survived it, and was interested enough later to help establish, it was then called Quetico area, still is in some places, but also she had a deep interest in mental health, and was in the legislature when, and was present at the signing of the bill for the first, what was then called, psychopathic hospital. Very interested in common law marriages, family and children law, narcotics. She got interested in the whole problem of narcotics through international women's work. She attended international women's conferences. She also, through her work with the Women's Christian Association and the young women coming to the city, saw what loan sharks, the exorbitant interest they were charging many of these young people and others, and sponsored bills year after year after year to regulate small loans, and was able to. Was one of the founders of the Urban League, and yet called blacks coloreds, and one had the sense that she never had one in her home except as a servant. She was really a benefactor and a patroness, but an amazing woman. One cannot help but admire, and later helped Sally Luther, who ran from the same seat and served for quite some time from that district. Meanwhile, across the Mississippi, on the other side of the tracks, if you know Minneapolis, literally as well as the other side of the river, was Myrtle Cain, who was mentioned. Born and raised in northeast Minneapolis, still lives in the house she was born in on Madison Street Northeast. Her father was a railroad man, and she was an early labor organizer. She organized the telephone workers, was one of those who called the first telephone strike right smack out of high school, then got active, went to Washington, and I have never been able to figure out from Myrtle, and I was a friend of hers, still am, and listened to stories she told me from the time I started in politics, how she got from labor organizing to working with Alice Paul in the suffrage movement, but it happened. And she was very active in the Women's Party. Then came back home and got active in the Trade Union Women's League and ultimately the Farmer Labor Party. She ran in 1923, again, out of the suffrage movement, served only one term, but was called the flapper legislator, and apparently got a fair amount of nationwide publicity. She was part of the Catholic liberal community in the Farmer Labor Party, and in 1920, I think it may have been mentioned here, the Working People's League met in Rochester and adopted a platform that included equal rights for women, the eight-hour day, workmen's compensation, public ownership of railways, banks and utilities, market agencies, income and inheritance taxes, and a federal Department of Education, and restoration of civil rights for those accused of subversion during World War II. Politics were in ferment, and Myrtle Cain came out of this movement, essentially the third, was one of the third-party movement women. Her candidacy boomed when she went in to talk to Henry Tigan, an activist editor of the Farmer Labor newspapers. And Tigan asked her why she didn't run. And so she stopped by the courthouse and checked with a friend, Dick Wiggin, who gave her the filing fee, or a $20 contribution, and told her to go file. And she did without telling her family. She spent the summer essentially going from door to door in northeast Minneapolis, and won the election. Items on her campaign card included a reduction of taxes on home, a royalty tax on iron ore, and ample money to secure the power at the High Dam for Minneapolis and the university. She appealed to her district as well as to women in her district. She talked about going around in the afternoons and visiting the women in the community. She also was very active in the ethnic, it is an ethnic neighborhood, and she has some interesting stories to tell about that. But let me move on to Koya Knutson. Again, from the northern part of the state, we have this pattern, Minneapolis and the northwest corner. Koya Knutson was a wife and mother, in addition to being a politician, but she paid the price for being an unconventional woman. She was fine in the legislature, but and accepted, but she offended the Democratic My Own Party regulars by running against an endorsed DFL candidate, a cardinal sin in the 1950s, in the highly disciplined party of that time. For that sin, she supported Estes Kefauver in the 1956 presidential primary against Adlai Stevenson. The men in this, in my party, really took out after her. Koya was defeated in her bid to return to Congress for a third term and is remembered nationwide for her husband's plea, "Koya, come home." You ought to know a little about that husband. But that didn't matter to my my friends. Support for Kefauver was really the last straw. Previously, Koya had offended party leaders by her unconventional behavior. She was a little flamboyant in her dress and manner after she went to Washington, shedding somewhat her schoolteacher image. She was really a very friendly, garrulous person. But she did not meet the unwritten qualifications for a woman politician of the 1950s. That woman might be strong-minded and active in her community and in her party, but she should dress and act conventionally and not draw attention to herself. Koya Knutson was a woman politician in a tough-minded, highly disciplined, socially conventional, but politically liberal party. And she did not meet those qualifications so far as discipline and public behavior was concerned, so they defeated her. I only really realized what happened to Koya when I did the research for this chapter. I was present while a lot of this was going on and, of course, was active myself. But I only really understood exactly what happened after I had my own consciousness raised, I guess, as a result of the women's movement. Sally Luther was another conventional, unconventional person. She was acceptable to DFL party leaders up until the end, when she did an unconventional thing. Her early biography reads like Mrs. Community Service. Elected in the 60s or before, Sally Luther was not geographically mobile. She went to Vassar College. She was born and raised in Kenwood. Went to Vassar College, came back. She was middle class, knew her community, but she was a newspaper reporter in a day when not many women worked outside the home. She knew she was competent and capable, and she had the energy, stamina, and competitiveness necessary to carry out a good campaign. She went to Maybeth Heard Page and asked her advice, and got a lot of it. She also, that worked. It was the same district, and Maybeth Heard Page not only gave her money, but people to contact. Emily Nubule helped her. Emily Nubule was active in the DFL it was by then, party. She was then retired, had a distinguished career, which included teaching in Minneapolis public schools, overseas work during World War I, a city planner in Rochester, and a stint as executive secretary of the Business and Professional Women in Washington, which she left over differences on the Equal Rights Amendment. Nubule and other women liberals did not support the Equal Rights Amendment at that time because they were afraid of learning the hard-earned protective legislation for women. We can go into that. It's a whole other story. But Nubule was then spending much of her retirement in political activity. She ran as Secretary of State with Byron G. Allen, known as Barney Allen, as governor on the ticket of the newly formed DFL party in 46. But both Emily Nubule and Maybeth Page were good friends of Mac Martin, a family friend and later husband of Sally's mother, and he also helped in that campaign. Sally was elected and reelected, but never ran first, and was finally defeated essentially in a very close election because of the way her name was listed on voting machines. Literally, she was listed in the Republican column and in Democratic precincts, and it undid her. With a reporter's eye for details and a good story and a politician's interest in people, Sally has a number of wonderful stories. But serving in the legislature was her first experience with farmers, and she was absolutely fascinated by them. And she tells the story and still just chuckles or really laughs. She has a very deep, loud voice. And she tells the story of the legislator who got elected, and he brought along a constituent, a farmer, and together they walked into the rotunda, and the farmer looked up and says, "Boy, could you get a lot of hay in here?" Every time you go in the rotunda. Sally was active in education and really became a distinguished DFL legislator, a brilliant woman. Unfortunately, a part of the minority, so I suppose her most of the time, a couple of times the Liberals were in the majority. She worked on Fair Employment Practices Commission legislation as well as fair housing. Her unconventional behavior was that she eventually divorced her husband and married another man, and they left and moved to New York. Again, she was not really tolerated for that unconventional behavior at the end. Helen McMillan, many of you know about, who also served in the legislature for many years. She came out of the League of Women Voters, had no children. After serving in the League for many years, when a vacancy occurred in her district, she came from Austin and was the first person from the southern part of the state. Served for, I can't recall exactly how many years, was one of the leaders in the abortion fight, born and raised in Minneapolis, and was a dancer before she was active in the League of Women Voters. The McMillans, as I said, had no children, but she followed the more usual female pattern of running for the legislature later than most men after a career of volunteer community service. At age 65, after her husband's death, she decided she had served long enough and retired. Well, they're an interesting lot, the women who served in the Minnesota legislature. Hannah Kempfer, whom I mentioned, was one of those elected in 1923, was an illegitimate child, born at sea, raised in western Minnesota by farm families. Just to read her early life is to almost weep. But the four women in the 1923 legislature combined to have to take off some of the curse of being an illegitimate child legally. There have been three or four bills, but this one was the first. Sue Dickey Huff, to this day, is an ardent conservative, served only one term. Esther Fieldman and Phyllis Kahn are the two women Jews, who have been elected, one from outstate, one from in Minneapolis. Esther Fieldman was from Park Rapids, came from Brooklyn. And one would say a woman like that could never get elected. A woman like that did get elected and served a couple of terms. As I mentioned, most of the legislators have come from what was called the old 9th District, now the 7th, which was the seat of most of the activity of the farmer labor movement, the nonpartisan league, and come out of this liberal third party tradition. We have now another woman from the central part of the state, Claudia Mayer. None have ever come from what's known as the 8th District, Duluth and the Iron Range. It's fascinating to speculate how and why a number of women have been elected from the same district: Phyllis Kahn, Alpha Smaby, and Myrtle Kane, all three from what's called an ethnic or working man's district. Myrtle did not have part of the University of Minnesota, all of the University of Minnesota Alpha and Phyllis Dew from their districts, as I said, Sally and Mabeth Heard Page, Kempfer, Naplin, and Coya, all from essentially the same place. Why is there a climate and an acceptance for women in one particular place and not another? Why is there this kind of willingness to pioneer? Why do some women run for the legislature or for political office? And why don't you? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Arvind. Next, we turn to another aspect of women's involvement in political life. And I guess I'd like to ask a man to comment on that. I'd like to introduce to you John Milton, who is a state senator from White Bear Lake. And I'll refrain from any jokes about Paradise Lost and the Equal Rights Amendment.
Excuse me. Well, I think there was a decided emphasis for equal rights legislation starting in the 1973 session. Although, as you've heard, there had been women in the legislature, there had never been a gathering of them. And at the time, and I guess as late as December of 1972, Helen McMillan was the only one in the House, and there were none in the Senate. And there had been very few, even with those whose careers we've heard about tonight, who'd been like Phyllis Kahn and Linda Berglund. I'm not sure, but it's it sounds to me from what the history of previous legislators are, Vaughn, that Linda may have been the first single woman that was elected. I don't know that, but Myrtle Cain. But and Linda continues single. And when they did come in, it coincided with an effort from all over the state through leagues of women voters and through other organizations. And of course, the impetus given to the ERA by Congress to take that issue up, and it did come up very early in 1973. I remember as a candidate in 1972 being exposed to the issue very early. I was a county commissioner at that time, and I never thought I'd have to face anything like that. And having the ERA issue brought before candidate meetings and having to deal with it. And I also recall as late as 1974 having candidates out in suburban Ramsey County not having heard of the ERA. But it was a beginning of awareness for a lot of us that it was an important issue. And if we had thought that in our benevolent way that we'd given the women the right to vote in 1920, and that was the last we were going to hear of them, we were in for a shock in 1973. The battle for the ERA was a very long and protracted one. In the Senate, the ERA bill ratification of the ERA had to make it through one of the most senior and most crusty boys' clubs in the state Senate called the Judiciary Committee. And it survived country lawyers and city lawyers and constitutional experts and people that were just plain scared because they were getting heat from the right wing in their district. But it did get through, and it did serve as an impetus once we had the ERA ratified in Minnesota for a number of other bills that were identified then by our staff and by individual members of the legislature as being the follow-up to ERA. We did not, of course, have to deal with sending our boys and girls off to war, and we didn't have to deal with the privacy issue of whether or not you can have men's and women's rooms and all the other scary things about the ERA that we all are reading now from the right-wing press. But we did have to deal with some bills that would have enabled us to put the philosophy of the ERA into Minnesota statutes and eliminate obvious and mechanical kinds of discrimination. I'll give you a few examples of that. There were 16 bills to implement the ERA drafted by the staff of the Senate Judiciary Committee in the summer of 1973 during the interim, and there were extensive hearings on them during that time. When we came back in 1974, the legislature actually took action on very few of those, and I'll describe them briefly, and I know Phyllis is who was the chief author and really the prime mover behind a couple of them, would like to go into more detail. But they did include rape counseling bill, equal penalties for prostitution, and a name change bill that passed the House but not the Senate. So that as of the first 2 years of that effort, let's say we are concluding now the first term of legislators like Linda Berglund and Phyllis Kahn, we had passed the ERA and perhaps three other pieces of legislation that were significant in the area of equal rights, but we'd failed in a number of other efforts. And I guess if I were to look back historically, that was the effort to try to implement the spirit of the ERA was the beginning of the backlash. 1975, we saw the arrival of Janet Clark and Peggy Byrne, who were two people distinguished, I think, very early in their careers by taking on and beating incumbent Democrats in the primary, getting the endorsement, taking it away from them and winning tough challenges in a couple of blue-collar labor districts, one in Ramsey County in what's known as Frogtown in St. Paul, and the other in I believe it's a part of southeast Minneapolis, and beat people who had been men who had been in the legislature for a long, long time, and survived that only to be turned away at the lunch counter of the St. Paul Athletic Club, which you may recall. There was another strong effort in 1975, but there were few successes, which I'll give you a little indication of. And another event happened just after we'd gotten back. There was a special election in Olmsted County in Rochester, and the first state senator who had ever been elected not having succeeded her husband. So, and Nancy really is an original, although she's the second to serve in the legislature. She is the first to be elected in her own right. And she was sworn in, I believe, shortly after we'd all come back to the men's club, and she was greeted by something which I thought was going to be the opening of real awareness in the Senate. I had tried the year before to wear a turtleneck on the floor of the Senate. I'd been asked by the majority leader to get a tie and not to come back after lunch without a tie, or the sergeant-at-arms would eject me. So I did put a tie over the turtleneck, and I managed to make it through the rest of the day. Nancy arrived without a tie, and there were a couple of reasons I was very glad to see her. And but you know, the Senate being what it is, that was not going to go unnoticed. So as in the middle of the swearing-in proceedings in which she was taking the oath of office and being the first to serve in her own right, one of our distinguished senators, also from the south eastern part of the state in a neighboring district by the name of Baldy Hansen, arose and challenged her being on the floor and challenged her disrespect for the traditions of the Senate. And I believe that happened just prior to or shortly following the oath taking, and so there was a chance there for a fleeting moment that we would retain our status as a boys' club along with the St. Paul Athletic Club. Didn't make it, and she's there now, and we're very glad to have her. The Senate, in its own deliberate way, finally did pass the name change bill and the school athletic bill, but we did not get home entirely free on that one. In the middle of the floor debate on the school athletic bill, a promised threat to repeal the ERA vote that had been taken 2 years prior to that materialized, and a very talented polka player from the northern part of the state, and is from the 8th District, by the way, which is appropriate, I guess, Arvon, in view of the comments you made, made a motion along with school athletics we were going to get the repeal of the ERA. The vote was, I think, 34-34 or 33-33, and it was a cliffhanger and a heart stopper, and it was less than 2 years since the time we had passed the ERA and ratified it, and although the votes on the ERA 2 years prior to that had been, I think, 47-10, we had lost that number of distinguished senators who had fled the movement. We did manage to amend the Veterans Preference Law to eliminate absolute preference, which is an opening up for opportunities for women in public employment, particularly in local government. And we also did pass a bill that relates to penalties for criminal sexual conduct, which was known thereafter as the fanny padding bill, which lost a lot of its importance, at least in the way that the public perceived it through that. We did make unlawful to discriminate against women in the matters of credit, and we passed what was described later as being a half-assed measure to eliminate half of the pay toilets in the state of Minnesota, which is considered to be a very sensitive issue at the time, and which is rather unbelievable. I guess I had come a long way in my own perception of what was going on the other side of the line, and I had gotten to the point where people in the Feminist Caucus were actually inviting me down to drink wine occasionally with them at Fioritos, and they were excusing a couple of my bad votes and saying that in another 20 years I might be there. And until we hit paid toilets, and I was first made aware of that bill. A very nice-looking gentleman arrived at my office and just simply walked in, and he was looking terribly harassed. He'd been down the hall, and Dave Schaff had a session with him, and Dave was the author of the bill, and he was just asking. He said, "At this point, I know we people are going to get rid of toilets." He said, "But I want to compromise." And he said, "Politics is the art of compromise, and I'm willing to go halfway with you." Turns out he's the guy that makes the locks on the paid toilets. There's got to be somebody someplace that makes those things, and there he was. He was really, I should have had him bronze because he never have that kind of opportunity again. But we did begin to get the backlash, and as I say, we got the backlash in the vote on ERA. We got more difficulty than I would have expected for a very simple bill that does allow women to, at the time of marriage, to retain their maiden name and not to have to go through a little hassle later on if they want to go back to it for professional or other reasons and hope to get a good judge and a good lawyer to coincide with each other. That's something, and to have that all happen. And we just ran into an awful struggle on that one. And on the floor, it was looking very grim, and I think if it had not been for Senator Braddis from Rochester, with a couple of arguments that I couldn't have made, and she did at a critical time and swung, I would say, the number of votes we needed to get that bill off the floor of the Senate. So it's kind of, if you ever doubt that you need more women in legislatures to pass this legislation, that was the proof of the pudding. But we also began to get a kind of a crazy reaction to some things. For example, there was a bill up for community health services, which was a program to provide state subsidies to local nursing services and home health agencies, and to go, just a long list of community, public, and preventive health services, which we had worked on for years and just had finally gotten up to the point, and it hit the floor of the House, and we had the most unbelievable kinds of amendments to eliminate family planning, to say family planning only when you had, what was it, 2 feet on the floor or something. It was just the most unbelievable thing, and they came very close to eviscerating the bill on the floor of the House with those kinds of amendments. And then they began seeing in every kind of public health service a clinic that would be set up to give free abortions to people. So that we went through that and a whole new series of amendments that I think were designed really to gut the bill. It finally did get through the House and the conference committee, and it remains at the desk of the Senate. It's kind of sleeping there for the summer, and it will come out, I hope, the first day of the session. But that was the kind of feeling that I got in contrast with the 1973 session. So as I may be giving you the downside of things, but I'm giving my perception as somebody who's been there and felt the real enthusiasm and commitment to equal rights legislation in 1973. And now, feeling a little bit nervous about how we're going to go forward with this, and I don't know whether that can be generalized through the state of Minnesota in terms of how many more women we're going to be able to elect to the legislature, but we certainly need a lot more in the Senate. 1976, we hope to have a bill up, which I think is an important one, and which does involve potentially more women in positions of responsibility. And it's being heard now in the Subcommittee of Government Operations. It'll be referred to hereafter, I think, as the Open Appointments Bill. The origin of it, I believe, is from a Citizens League report that tried to describe the process of gubernatorial and other kinds of appointments as being just a little bit less than representative, and that we ought to begin to systematize it. The bill is up, and I have it here, and there are a number of good provisions, but I won't go into detail. It simply would provide a very, very open process by which when positions on boards and commissions and other kinds of public agencies in the state of Minnesota are open, that they would have to be registered with the Secretary of State, they would have to be published, the organizations and community groups and minority groups and women's groups would then be aware of the fact that these were available. They could then submit the names of applicants for these jobs. They would have to be considered. There would have to be a recording and a reporting by the appointing bodies, the governor or other agencies making appointments to these commissions and boards of how many women and how many minority people, and we could begin to develop an ongoing set of statistics and a performance record on our governors to see that, all rhetoric aside, what are our governors doing to put women who are capable, and many are, and many are not getting an opportunity to serve in these particular bodies. And these are the regulatory bodies and boards and commissions, by the way, that do, between the time that the legislature comes and goes, which we still do like Cinderella in the state of Minnesota, these are the people who are making rules and regulations and having an awful lot of effect on the ongoing process of government. And there, I'll give you a couple of examples of how well we're doing currently with representation of women. Recently, in the 1975 legislature, we created a commission for the development of small business. The appointments were made to that commission and not one woman. I would say that if in any area of commerce and industry there is representation by women, it is in the area of small business. There are probably more small business women in the state of Minnesota than there are women in corporate executive positions. And so it was a natural area for a woman to be appointed, not one. In the area of energy, an energy task force was created and a recent set of appointments were made. Only one out of 11 women were appointed to that particular task force. Even though women, through driving, through their management of the home, through use of appliances and everything else, probably consume outside of industry, the majority of the use of energy in the state of Minnesota, only one out of 11 women. There's no excuse for that. Part of the problem has been that the appointing authorities have not had really a grasp of what they were doing. There hasn't been a public reporting and accountability of it. And this bill will be coming out of government operations and hitting the floor of both the Senate and the House this year. And it's one that if you want to know what to do in 1976, it is a bill that needs your support. I guess finally, I just have to say, as I look back over the thing, I would have to leave you with this comment. If you do believe in the Equal Rights Movement, if you believe in the Equal Rights Amendment that we ratified, if you hope, as I do, that four more states will ratify it, that I think we have something to be concerned about. I don't propose that you go to Illinois and try to persuade them to do it, although that's not a bad idea. Right here in Minnesota, I think we have had a backlash. It's come progressively and insidiously through some of the events that I have mentioned, and although I think, you know, we've in the last 3 years we've probably done some things that we can deserve to be proud of, and I say that I'm somewhat sensitive to the fact that it may sound patronizing coming from me. The point of the matter is that the sense of movement and of the commitment that we had in 1973 seems to have been eroded, and I fear that those issues are going to be on a negative side in the 1976 campaigns, and if you do believe in those things that I just mentioned, I hope you'll join and be active and committed politically on either side of the fence and help elect more women to the state senate. For God's sake, it's still a big men's club. We need more like Nancy Bratis and in other districts as well. Thank you.